This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris. Today we've got Steve Bastin. He joins us today from John Burns Real Estate Consulting, where he supports the firm's building products research, including their in-depth forecasts of building product spending in new construction and remodeling in markets, and additionally is responsible for demand forecasting and sector coverage of all residential building products categories, which is why he's here today. And then before joining John Burns Real Consulting, he worked at Kohler as product manager, and before that as Kohler's corporate development officer as a merger and acquisition analyst. So lots of background in design and construction. So thanks for joining us, Steve. For those of you who aren't familiar with John Burns Real Estate Investing, Steve, could you give them a brief sort of explanation of what your company does?
Hey, Aaron. Thank you so much for having us. Really appreciate your time and bringing us on the show. Happy to answer that. So, you know, John Burns Real Estate Consulting, we're located in Southern California, based out of Irvine. Provide really in-depth research and consulting services related to the housing industry. You know, we're enabling growth. We're really giving expert advice to home builders and investor clients, building product manufacturers. We just really vie to be the most trusted and respected, U.S. housing market analysts and consultants that we can be. But we were founded in 2001. John Burns, our CEO, really saw a need for better analysis in the housing market. And the company has just grown into this highly passionate team of research analysts and consultants across country. We work together. We really just provide the best, most trusted U.S. housing analysis. And we're just here to really help everyone make smart investment decisions. And that's really our purpose.
And your emails are one of the things I look forward to. And it's the entire reason I reached out to you. If you're not on their email list, you need to go to their website and check it out. I was interested when you and I were emailing back and forth before the interview that new construction is only really 30% of what exactly that you do. So the product that you're worried about, because you're working with big box retailers like Home Depot and Lowe's, right? So obviously their main focus are the average consumer and rehabbers, right?
You know, the market opportunity for various building product categories is different. So let's say plumbing. Plumbing, the end market opportunity might be 60 to 70% repair and remodel and 30% or so new construction. And there's some commercial in there too, of course, but we're just talking residential. And but for, roofing, for example, that's more like 80 to 90%, repair and remodel and 10 to 20% new construction. It's tied less to housing starts than some other categories. Lumber is tied more to housing starts. There's a lot of framing lumber. OSB and all that stuff that goes into a new start. So kind of by category, by product type, there's just much different end market opportunity. But in general, I think across the spectrum, HVAC to plumbing to windows and doors, flooring to appliances, the market tends to be more R&R than new construction. I think the general rule is, 60 to 70-ish percent of the end market opportunity is really R&R. So that's where, myself and my boss, Todd Tom, really spent a lot of our time, focusing on what's going on there.
I just realized I'm used to hearing research and development, but what is the second R in R&R?
Oh, I'm sorry. R&R is repair and remodel.
Oh.
Repair, replacement, repair, remodel. You're repainting your walls. You're swapping out an old appliance. You're swapping out an old faucet. You're doing a full remodel. You're doing a full kitchen remodel, kitchen cabinets and countertops and plumbing and lighting and everything, right? So that's really what we're talking about when we talk about R&R.
So when the National Association of Home Builders, they've got an index, is that index really tracking consumer? It would capture everything from the consumer repairing their home all the way to real estate investors completely renovating a home. Would that be fair to say?
I'm not sure what index you're talking about. Is it NHAB's?
They have like a rehabilitation. I just always was curious. We were part of the building association here locally for a while, and there was like a subgroup of remodelers, and I just never got really active. And I was just curious, what they're really focus is on.
It's possible that it tracks repair and remodel. I'm actually not familiar with that index.
Okay.
But there's certainly someone at the firm that it probably is.
I'll call. So when it comes to design, I want to get into some trends overall in housing stock. But when it comes to design, where does it typically start? You know, when it comes to fashion, I always think like, oh, it probably starts in New York and Fashion Week or somewhere in Italy. But is HDTV driving it? Is it builders, design trends, and they're doing all this research? Like, where do they make their designs for building, but as well as the products that they're going to be featuring in Home Depot and Lowe's?
You know, that's a great question. And I think it totally depends on the channel. So, you know, Depot and Lowe's are going to be designing products, you know, for their customer base. You know, wholesale plumbing or kitchen distributors are going to be designing products for, you know, the pro remodeler. And then there's other channels, you know, there's wholesale channels that design specifically for architects and designers. So, you know, it really depends on the customer base. But yeah, I think a general rule of thumb for repair and remodeling, especially remodeling, because I think remodeling tends to lead design, and then kind of new construction, we'll see what's going on. And, you know, very high end fashion forward remodelers, from, you know, the world's best designers, and they'll try to fast follow them. But yeah, I think, you know, design inspiration comes from a wide variety of places. It could come from Fashion Week. You know, when I worked in new product development at Kohler Company, and you know, the industrial designers, very in touch with what's going on, from, you know, color trends to shape trends to just feature sets with, you know, textures and materials and, you know, matte finishes to gloss and all that stuff. So that, you know, they take inspiration from what's going on sometimes in the fashion world, whether that's clothing or, you know, other industrial product design. You know, I mean, I've seen inspiration boards that have everything from, you know, silverware to cars to, you know, to clothing. So it really kind of just depends on what they feel is the most inspiring part of that design aesthetic, and they'll try to group it together and then, you know, build it into, you know, an appliance or mm-hmm. a faucet, for example. So I think great design tends to probably start in New York, you know, the design hubs of the world: New York, Milan, Chicago, Los Angeles, and they work their way, you know, and then they proliferate. But yeah, inspiration can come from a variety of sources.
The day that this airs, I will actually be at a fashion show in New York City. I have a niece that her product is being featured on a runway, oddly enough. I've never been. I lived in New York City for 7 years, and I've just always wondered, you know, it's just, where does this design stem from, especially when it comes to architecture and design products and whatnot. So let's get into some trends in housing. Tiny houses, micro living. Let's talk about maybe what the difference is between those, and what is it? What is micro living in your opinion?
Micro living. Oh boy. That is, to me, that is the smallest format of apartment living. You know, that's very minimalistic, in lifestyle. I can give you an example. I actually live in a pretty small apartment. It's a studio. It's 540 square feet, and that's not even, I think, considered micro living. So, you
know, semi micro
format than that. So, what's that?
Semi micro.
Yeah, it would be semi micro. Yeah, but yeah, no, micro would be, you know, just think of very minimalistic footprint. You know, maybe, you know, the bed would fold down from the wall. You know, there's not a formal dining area. You know, it's a very small, compact kitchen, you know, maybe a 2-burner or a 4-burner stove, you know, smaller, compact refrigerator, very small format bathroom. So just, you know, minimalistic. The consumer that's trying to live micro is not accumulating a lot of possessions. You know, it's an interesting trend. It's probably geared, you know, in more common in millennial generation. You know, you see a lot of these documentaries, you know, where that age group is just simply more inclined to travel, you know, less inclined to stay in a place for very long. You know, they're moving more often. So it's a very interesting trend.
I think one of my,
definitely something that I think isn't going away.
One of my favorite projects I've seen on this is, there's the oldest existing mall, is in Rhode Island. And there's a project called the Arcade Providence. The bottom floor is retail and the top two floor are micro apartments. And I think the vast majority of them are around 250 square feet. It's a super tiny, basically hot plate, mini refrigerator, little living area and bathroom. There's a bed in the back and a desk, but it's super minimal. And it just reminds me of when I lived in New York. So
Yeah, you know, it's almost like they're taking inspiration from New York and just making it fashionable, right? But, you know, that's interesting that you point out the retail on the first floor because, you know, John and a couple others at the firm have really coined an amazing term that they call Surban. Surban is, you know, kind of that suburban-urban living. And, you know, it typically is retail on the first floor. It's not in, you know, a downtown of New York City or Chicago. It's a little bit closer to the suburbs, but you get that urban feel, that lifestyle with some, you know, suburban amenities. So, you know, you're close to good restaurants, to good grocery stores, you know, all that stuff. So that's a really interesting concept that some of the suburban lifestyles now gearing more towards a micro product type. That's interesting.
And what was interesting is that the target market for that, and that's partly why I wanted to talk about demographics around these as well, is that it seemed like it was professionals. So there was nurses there, I think doctors, and also entrepreneurs that actually had businesses in the building at the bottom. And of course, those were like co-work spaces. So it's just, it had so many trends. And the beauty of it was in the oldest existing mall in America kind of thing. So I was like, oh, that's apropos. So how does micro living compare to tiny houses? I laugh because I have lots of people in my life who are in the mobile home space. And I'm just like, these are just really fancy mobile homes.
Well, they are, yeah. I mean, I think that's a simple way to say it. But you know, there's certainly similarities and there's certainly differences. You know, similarities would be, you know, these tend to be, you know, homeowners, you know, residents that value fewer possessions. You know, they want more flexibility in their lives to be able to travel if they want. You know, there's not a huge emphasis on a lot of material, a lot of square footage. That's similar to micro living, right? But a difference, I think, is clearly they're detached. You know, they're detached homes, so they're often maybe in a little more rural area or less, you know, in a less urban area. But yeah, you know, there are similarities for sure. I mean, they tend to be similar demographics. You know, I think millennials are probably more inclined to you know, live in a tiny house versus, you know, a family of five, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, there's similarities and there's differences, but I don't think there's too much departure between the two.
Do you think, as far as micro living, and this, maybe I shouldn't lump these together, but micro living and tiny homes, do you think these are trends here to stay, or will they go the way of my, what do they call it? Condo hotels in the last downturn.
Condo hotels. I'm not familiar with that, actually.
Oh, geez. It's where they converted hotel rooms into rentable, like, condos, sort of like Airbnb, sure. Before they became popular. See? Goes to prove my theory.
I wonder if some of that was just driven by, you know, maybe in the downturn, there was just, they needed to convert them to something. You know, I don't know a lot about that.
It was a money-making thing.
Interesting. Sure. Yeah.
Do you think these will stick around?
I don't know if it's here to stay or not. I think it's a little early to tell. You know, but I can tell you just from a demographic standpoint that, you know, millennials, as they come to form households, you know, there's certainly going to be a segment of that demographic uses to live in, you know, minimalistic format home. You know, they're not going to probably be as inclined to move up into, you know, 4,000 square foot homes like perhaps maybe previous generations had. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there will be clear demographic differences. We cover a lot of those, you know, at the firm. We have, you know, a team that really covers demographics and everything. So that's a really interesting concept and probably one that we should dig farther into.
It'll be interesting to see as seniors if they decide to downsize. Some of the seniors in my life have gone from 3,600 square feet to over 4,000. So it's hard to know, but you know, we live in California in the Inland Empire, but I've lived in big cities a decade out of my life. So I have a very different perspective and I'm great at small spaces. I would rather do things. So I think the demographics piece is really important. And as a real estate investor, as I'm investing in rentals in space, I am looking at things like the economy. And I love John's book, Big Shifts Ahead, where it talks about the demographics, their behavior, where they're going, and some of the trends that he's, you know, the company is seeing. But the micro living is just an interesting concept. So let's go to co-living, because I think it sort of blends a little bit of the micro living. How do you describe co-living?
Boy, co-living. Yeah, this is your Airbnb type of situation, your VRBO. These are people that just need a solution, you know, usually temporary, just for housing. And I'll give you a personal example, because it's something that I'm really looking into right now. I live in the Midwest. You know, it's a temporary spot for me right now. I have a studio apartment in the downtown area, but you know, I am looking to break the lease. I'm looking to break the lease because I know I'm going to be moving eventually. And, you know, temporarily I need a housing solution, and I've looked at Airbnb, and in the area, there's a lot of Airbnb, you know, hosts that will do, you know, a 1 or 2 week stint, and, you know, it's $10 a night in some cases. So
wow.
You know, I look at that and I go, boy, absolutely, you know, 10 to 20 bucks a night. And I'm in a lower rent market in general. I'm not in California, I'm in Wisconsin, but, you know, to me, I look at that and I go, boy, 30 nights a month, at $10 a night, that's only $300. That's less than a third of what I pay in rent. So
wow.
You know, to me, it's a very attractive solution if, you know, if I'm light on possessions and I don't need a lot, and you know, I can move some of my stuff into my parents' house, you know, temporarily. But to me, that's a very compelling thing because it offers me the flexibility. I travel a lot for work, so I wouldn't need to be here, you know, more than 2 weeks a month. So, you know, I think you just look at, you know, the young professional or someone who's just really a little bit of a nomad. And that's such an attractive thing when you don't have to have a home base where you just need a temporary housing solution. Certainly, you know, rents vary widely by market. But like I said, it's $10. In some cases, it's $10 a night where I live. So what an attractive thing when, you know, you can save that $600-$700 a month. And start to create a nest egg, maybe buy something, you know?
Yeah, it varies so much. It reminds me a lot of when I first moved to New York City, I lived in a residential hotel in Midtown Manhattan, and at the very top with a youth hostel. And at the time, I had never been exposed to that, but if you're not familiar with it, it's huge in Europe. But, you know, you pay a very minimal amount to be in a huge room with a bunch of other people. It might be co-ed, it might not, but you're with bunk beds. And a business has popped up in LA. If you're in California, look up podshare.co.
Podshare, okay.
Podshare, you pay in Hollywood $50 a night or $15 for a day. So I guess if you want to take a nap. And it's literally an open room with oversized bunk beds. It's hilarious. And you just have to, I think,
probably a little cleaner than some of the hostels you might find.
Australia. This is definitely an upgrade, but it's just really interesting to see their target is clearly millennials. And it's almost offensive if you're in the real estate investing or if you're a realtor, you read the language of how they're describing the process. They're sort of saying, screw ownership. Who needs that? You need flexibility. It's really fun to read. It's clear who their target market is, but as far as co-living, I also see some really interesting design trends in urban markets where builders are specifically building spaces to where you've got maybe a 3-bedroom apartment. It's fully furnished. They do a beautiful job on the main living quarters, a high-end kitchen, highly designed, awesome living, like a family room. And then you've got 2 bathrooms, and the consumer is coming in is paying one fee that's going to include rent, utilities, maid service. You know, they're surrounding it with services and they just pay one fee. And the target market for one that I'm thinking in particular is technical people in the Bay Area, people who are engineers, and it's just fascinating to me. So there's sort of like a lower end where you've got Podshare in Los Angeles, where it's clearly the millennials, but then this co-living situation where builders are actually building to suit for professionals that sort of talked about what you want, but they plan on sticking around a long time, but they don't know if it's going to be 6 months or 3 years. So I'm excited about this category. I even have real estate investors that are doing similar things in the single family rental space. They rent out each room separately and they just surround it with services. So it's just a play on a fully furnished rental. They're just doing it by room. And she says that she gets the professional market, teachers, nurses, I just think it's really, and couples too, young couples. So I don't know.
You know, that's such an interesting thing. And if you look at, you know, how we break up demographics in our book, in John's book, you know, that the 1980s and 1990s, those are the sharers and the connectors, right? So, you know, these are generations that are used to sharing, you know, they're used to, you know, to sharing possessions and things. And, you know, they probably grew up sharing a room with their siblings, or, you know, they're just more inclined to, they're more comfortable, I would say, living in shared environments. And I think now, more than ever before, you know, you have these platforms like, you know, Airbnb and Vrbo, where these are like verified hosts. you know, this is, there's generally, you know, a safety factor. You're comfortable, you know, sharing an environment with someone because it's generally known that they've been vetted if they have, you know, good reviews and all that stuff. So I think there's just more inclination to just do that. You know, I can save the money. You know, I live in Silicon Valley, for example, and God, rents out there, I mean, I can't even imagine, but you know, there's definitely value placed on being able to save a little bit, travel more, you know, not be so tied to a $2,500 a month, you know, rent expense, for example. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's fascinating. I agree with you 100%.
It's going to be interesting to see if seniors, the boomers, if they decide to, I mean, do you have any thoughts on if they're moving more to urban markets, if they might be interested in co-living as they look for connections as they age and maybe they lose friends? Like, I'm really interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I don't think it's too different from, you know, what we've seen in the last 30 years. I mean, certainly, you know, grandma and grandpa move in, you know, with the daughter or son in a lot of cases, you know, as they get older. Age in place is a huge thing. You know, I think you know, I can speak from like a building product standpoint. Just there's a lot of investment going on in designing and developing products that keep, you know, mom and dad in the home longer. You know, think of a bathtub that can be easily, you know, stepped into and stepped out of, that's comfortable, that keeps you warm while it fills the tub, you know, all these things that really, you know, keep mom and dad around longer, you know, wider, just in new construction too, wider entryways, wider doorways that can accommodate, you know, walkers or, you know, mobilized wheelchairs, the like. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly a lot of investment and, you know, awareness around what that generation needs to stay in the home longer. But I don't have specific kind of expertise in whether they're going to be choosing to like be in more co-living, like urban areas. That's a really interesting thought. I'm sure we have someone at the firm that has a strong opinion on that, but that's not my specific area of expertise.
Okay. Yeah, I'll come back to that because it might be a little bit too soon to tell, but this leads beautifully into multi-generational. And I bring it up because about once a quarter, I stop by a local building area and they're building out like 1,500 homes. And what's interesting compared to last time, they're not building the entire neighborhood and then selling the neighborhood. They're only building upon an order. But in this particular build out, there's two different phases and they're targeting different demographics. But this one, so far there's four phases and the two earlier ones sold out, and specifically the number two higher end on the first build out was specifically marketed multi-generational. And it's funny because this second phase with the two different model, two different neighborhoods with, I think they have three or four models each. Instead of multi-generational, I think they called it flexible housing or something, but it's basically the same thing with a junior suite on the bottom. But I just thought it was funny. Are you, any thoughts on sort of the multi-generational housing, if people are trying to get away from that term?
Yeah, I don't know if people are trying to depart from the term. You know, like I said, it's not like a new concept. You know, mom and dad have been moving in with their kids for a long time, but it is interesting to see, you know, the product shift. So if they're, you know, moving into an existing home, they might be, you know, moving into a new home now. So yeah, there's certainly, you know, more products out there, you know, in the new construction side that cater to the multi-generational buyer. But I don't think people are departing from the term. But you know, like think about demographics too. The demographics show that the 1950s innovators, the 1940s achievers, that generation, there's a lot of them, but you know, as they get older, they're going to need to have housing solutions if they want to stay out of assisted living. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And also you got the boomerang generation who's coming home to maybe after college to park it for a few years. So that extra space specifically allowing them a little bit more privacy and isolation. I don't know. And when I think multi-generational, I definitely think family with an older generation, but it maybe they're rebranding it slightly to really encompass the younger generation coming back as well. Who knows? So
that's a great point. Yeah, then there's probably some, you know, there's some rebranding happening just to kind of remove, it's not a stigma, but just give it a different connotation, you know, just make it more of a, you know, this is okay. This is a lifestyle now. This is, we want grandma and grandpa to be around. We want them to, you know, to stay out of the nursing home. Yeah, I can totally see that.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.